Hey guys, thanks for joining me for this 57th episode in Season 2 of Good Questions with Cameron Dole. Special guests on this episode include Dr. Randall Bell, who has a new book, Post-Traumatic Thriving: The Art, Science, and Stories of Resilience. We'll also visit with songwriter and guitarist Richard Thompson about his memoir, B-Swing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice. We'll also visit with documentary filmmaker Ken Burns about the new documentary Hemingway, which is streaming free now at pbs.org. We'll also visit with our good friend and country artist, Brandon Allen, talk about some upcoming singles, including his instrumental version of On the Road Again. Of course, if you would, please take the time to subscribe, drop a like, comment, leave some feedback, and share with your friends. Now, teenagers today were born between 2001 and 2008, so it's safe to say their childhoods looked quite a bit different than yours. Well, right now, people on Reddit are sharing things they used to do that teenagers today wouldn't be able to understand. And here are some of my favorites. Number 1, recording songs from the radio using a tape recorder. Number 2, spending 15 minutes untwisting a phone cord. Number 3, cleaning the mouse ball. Number 4, calling a phone number and having to ask if the person was there. Number 5, getting off the phone so someone else could use the internet. Number 6, calling a phone number to get the time. Number 7, loving the smell of mimeograph papers. Number 8, stopping at a gas station to ask for directions. Number 9, turning the channel 3 to play a video game. And number 10, watching the scrambled Playboy channel. Author has a post-traumatic thriving is the title of the book, The Art, Science, and Stories of Resilience. And as we exit the COVID-19 pandemic, Dr. Randall Bell, looking forward to talking about the new book.
Hey, same here, Cameron. Thank you.
Now, Dr. Bell, when did the process of writing the book, when did that start? Was it early in pandemic or was it maybe a little bit later that the idea came?
No, actually, the idea came about 10 years ago. I've been working on that book for 10 years, doing research academically, and then I followed people's stories to interweave with the science of it all. But my timing happened to coincide with COVID, but it's been a 10-year project.
Now, tell us a little bit about post-traumatic thriving and how the previous times kind of add together to make sense with COVID as well.
What's interesting is, I've had a career where I studied disasters. That's what I've been doing for 30 years. And cases like the World Trade Center and Flight 93 crash site and Hurricane Katrina and on and on. And I found fascinating were the people behind the statistics. I was working on these cases as an economist. And I was always intrigued by a certain group of society that after a tragedy, after a disaster, they bounce back better than they ever were before. Some people survive, and that's my hat's off to them. But some people really blast off and do remarkable things. So I started studying this phenomena of people thriving. I've been documenting their story for years now. And the basic essence is a conscientious decision to take the energy from the trauma, and there's a lot of energy, and to convert it into something that's going to propel you, beyond where you ever were.
And for you, Dr. Bell, a lot of folks are taking the trauma and using it as an excuse to maybe go a little farther inward or hold themselves back. Is that what you've seen as well?
Yeah. Like, for example, one person I followed, she was she still is a major Hollywood television producer. She had a life of luxury. A landslide smashed her house. I mean, literally just smashed it, uninhabitable. And her and her husband always had a dream of having a ranch. And, it was a big dream. It was really big. And so the landslide was kind of the catalyst to, get out of their comfort zone with luxury and do what they always wanted. We're kind of daydreaming about that. That's kind of the thing is that trauma can kind of wake you up.
And so many people have lost hope in this last year, this last 12 months we've been going through. But what do you think is the key point of not letting it get you down and moving forward and being, like it said, the stories of resilience that you share?
Yeah, well, there's two big, great lies I call them. The first one is it can't happen to me. because it can happen to me, you know. And the second one is there's no hope. There's always hope. These stories prove it. The science proves it. So, you know, we got to get over the lies that we tell ourselves and realize that, hey, no matter what, and the book proves it over and over again, that there's always hope.
And what was maybe the one of the biggest stories that really inspires you at this time as well from the book?
Oh, gee, there's about a dozen stories to pick from or more. But I guess one is I happened to grow up about two blocks away from Leo Fender, who, of course, invented the electric guitar. A lot of people don't realize that Leo had a glass eye. He was half blind and he was also deaf because some amplifiers blew out his hearing. The guy, amassed a fortune building Fender guitar. But, when $300 million were put into his account at that time, he was living in a mobile home. And guess what? He didn't even move. He wasn't motivated by money. He was motivated by his passion. He was motivated by wanting to help musicians. And that's really a big part of this, is having, you know, a cause, having a purpose that really, you know, challenges you and drives you forward. I always find Leo Fender very, very inspiring, and there's several others.
And for you, what maybe have you been doing to kind of help yourself avoid the doldrums over the last 12 months?
Well, I got COVID in January and it really knocked me over. So my heart goes out to all the people that have suffered from it. And I'm lucky because I'm still alive. But, I watched an awful lot of episodes of Swamp People. I can tell you that. But the book projects kept me very busy. But, you know, the last 12 months have been really tough on all of us. And we got to just stick together, support each other, and thank God we're kind of starting to come out of this thing. And be, you know, gratitude's a really big attribute of post-traumatic thriving. People that have gratitude instead of always complaining are the ones that really move forward.
And again, the book Post-Traumatic Thriving, The Art, Science, and Stories of Resilience. Now, Dr. Bell, what's it like to get the feedback from folks on the book, especially after you put so much blood, sweat, and tears into it, to get some good feedback from it? What's that mean to you?
Well, it means the world. And I so much appreciate being on your show because, you know, when as an author, you sit here for, you know, literally years, not all at once, but, you know, typing away, you know, it's vulnerable. You're putting your heart and soul into it. And you never know if people are going to like it or not. And to see the reviews, I mean, the editor of a medical journal, a medical doctor, you know, went on and on about how much it was. This is not a money-making project. The book's on Amazon for 99 cents on Kindle. But to see people that have been through a tough time and to get an email from them or something like that is as meaningful to me as the big reviews in the big newspapers. It's very satisfying to know that I'm doing something that is catching on, that people are on a practical basis are really helping them get through the tough times. It means the world.
Like we mentioned again, the Post-Traumatic Thriving, The Art, Science, and Stories of Resilience. And Dr. Bell, want to make sure and let our listeners know, you mentioned Amazon, but other places they can pick up the book and keep up with everything you got on social media wise as well.
Well, thanks. Yeah, Cameron, I'm at drbell.com. I'm very accessible. The book's on Amazon. It's in every bookstore. You know, it's out there. And so visit me at, I'd love it when people read it. And then visit me on drbell.com and let's keep the conversation going.
All right. Well, Dr. Bell, it's been great to visit with you. Looking forward to spending a little more time with the book myself. And hopefully you have a great weekend.
Hey, you too, Cameron. Appreciate it.
Well, if you thought your days of pretending to be in the Christina Aguilera Dirty video were behind you, well, we need to remind you that time is a flat circle. According to style experts, the fashion from the early 2000s is now back, and that includes low-rise jeans. One fashion journalist says the biggest sellers on a shopping app called Depop are all that, quote, vintage Y2K, satin bustiers, low-rise cargo pants, halter tops, and baby tees. Rock songwriter and also guitarist and now author added to that. Richard Thompson got the book B-Swing to talk about losing my way and finding my voice. And first off, Richard, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Now, when did you first think about putting thoughts down on paper, and did it take some arm wrenching to get you to do that in the first place?
It did take some arm wrenching, yes. Once I started the process, I really enjoyed it. I was happy to do it. And I think, that time period, the 60s into the 70s, seems to be very important for people. It still resonates today. I mean, people still love their Led Zeppelin and their Pink Floyd and their, Jethro Tull. It seems to be a very vibrant and very creative time. And I was young and things were happening for the first time, which is always makes things more alive for you. So I really wanted to concentrate on that time period.
Now, do you see the correlation between the time period of the 60s and 70s as opposed to what the folks are going through now, both artistically and maybe politically as well?
I think they're kind of distinct, really, distinctly different periods. There were a lot of factors that made up the 60s, some good, some bad. I mean, in America, you had much more of a political divide among the generations. And I think a lot of the music reflected that. In the UK, it wasn't quite so political, but it was also a watershed. It was a watershed between the wartime generation and the kids of the wartime generation, who wanted a bit of excitement in their lives. So that they loved rock and roll. They loved everything that came after that. And then they kind of rejected the culture of their parents, who wanted a safe, easy life after the war. And fair enough.
And as an artist growing up in the 60s and 70s, I mean, how difficult is it for you to share some of those stories? Because I know it's not all rainbows and butterflies, right, Richard?
No, I mean, I write about some difficult stuff. I mean, my band Fairport Convention, I had an accident that killed our drummer, and that was very traumatic for us. I think probably affected us for years at a time when, you didn't go and get therapy. I mean, people didn't think in that way. You just, chin up and get over it. So we kind of toughed it out for years, but we were kind of going to pieces inside. So I tried to write about that as honestly as possible. And, there were also great times. I mean, crazy times, the usual band stuff, that people get up to, the drugs, the drink, all that kind of stuff. Whatever I can remember. My memory is very selective. lots of stuff I don't remember. And I can compare notes with other band members, and say, do you remember this? And they say, no. But do you remember this? No. So all of our memories seem to just pick up on the stuff that we want to remember.
And how much, Richard, does the music, the songwriting, speak to the heart of what you went through? And how transparent was the writing as opposed to, that's one of the big key words these days is transparency, right?
Transparency. Well, I think writing a book is a lot more transparent than writing a song. In a song, you can be obscure. You can be obfuscating. You can write stuff that doesn't even have to make sense. In the name of, a more poetic approach or something. And if people don't understand what you're writing about in a song, then they just say, oh, you're a tortured genius. You must be because I can't understand it, so it must be great. Whereas if you're writing a book, you've got editors, you've got these people that you send the book to, and they say, what do you mean by this? And I'm thinking, well, how dare you ask me what I mean? But they're right. You have to make sense. So book writing is a lot more transparent, and it's a lot more honest and more heart-wrenching.
Now, is an editor or a producer harder to deal with in your mind?
I actually love my editors. Whatever I felt at the time, which was usually frustration and throwing things across the room, I came to love them and appreciate them deeply. Producers can be almost anything. You can have producers who don't know what they're doing. Lots of that goes on. And you think, how did they get the job? Other producers are absolute geniuses. And there are producers who will tailor everything to the sound that they want, a la Phil Spector. And there's producers who really want to find out about you, and they want to put you at the center of your own record. And for me, that's the best kind of producer.
Now, which is harder, the songwriting, writing lyrics, or just putting down the thoughts on paper? Maybe to pull those memories out, maybe that was the more difficult part.
It's all hard. Everything's hard. Everything's hard. Songwriting is hard. Writing lyrics is hard. Writing tunes is hard. Writing a book is hard. If it wasn't hard, maybe I wouldn't appreciate it, you know, but it's all tough in its own way.
Now, what has this last 12 months taught you to maybe appreciate a little more than that you may not have really had that appreciation of before?
Well, I'll never badmouth an audience again, ever. You know, they can be throwing things. They can be the worst audience in the world. They can be whistling, catcalling. I'll love them, whoever they are. It's so hard living without the live experience. It's been a very difficult year for most musicians that I know. And it's been a good time to write. So I've got lots written, but I can't wait to get back out there and tread the boards and play music to an actual audience. It'll be wonderful.
That's right. And again, the new book, B-Swing, the memoir, I should say, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice. Richard, I want to make sure and let folks know where they can find more information, not only about the book, but everything you've got going social media wise as well.
Well, you can go on my Facebook, just Richard Thompson. You can go on my website, Richard Thompson Music. And you can find the book at a bookstore near you. Support your local independent bookstore if you can, but otherwise it's up there online if you have to do that. Just Google me and you'll find it.
Well, Richard, it has been great to visit with you. I appreciate your time. Looking forward to spending more time with the book and hope you have a great weekend.
Thank you, Cameron. Same to you. Thanks so much.
Now, who would have ever guessed that the best way to get away with a crime would be to dress like a hack comic at a Chuckle Hut open mic night back in 1985? Well, a guy in his 20s robbed a bank in Bad Sodensel Münster in Germany on Tuesday. He pulled out a gun, demanded money, and took off with a bag of cash. But when the cops asked the bank staff and the witnesses to describe the guy, they couldn't, because they were too distracted by his colorful 80s-style tie. The police say, quote, "He did it very cleverly. Everyone focused on the ugly tie and didn't pay attention to his face. So the robber is still out there, and the police, they don't have any leads." Hemingway by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, the three-part documentary series, just finished up a couple of nights ago, but we've got Ken on to talk with us not only about Hemingway, but also another documentary we'll be visiting about. And Ken, always good to visit with you, sir.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
Now, Ken, with Hemingway, whenever you started out for the documentary, I mean, what was the first interest in the project for you?
Well, for me, it's been decades and decades long. I remember when I was a 15-year-old kid and read one of his short stories called The Killers, which just terrified me, intrigued me. There was nothing actually happened, and it was all about kind of stuff that was going to happen off stage. And somehow it was mesmerizing to me, and it didn't fit into any kind of story I'd ever read before. So I thought about him a lot, and as I grew older, I learned about his complicated life and the mythology that had grown up around him, and that was clear from reading other short stories and his great novels that he is arguably the greatest American writer of the 20th century. He certainly remade the short story and the novel, so much so that every writer writing today is in some way either influenced by Hemingway or consciously choosing not to go that way, which means they're influenced by Hemingway. So it was a great story, but what I wasn't prepared for, what we weren't prepared for, this was co-directed with Lynn Novick, is that he was such a complicated person. There's so much undertow. There's so many contradictions in him. And then it's a great tragedy, too, at the same time. Lots of demons in his life from all different directions that are sort of threatening to overtake him and do, unfortunately, overtake him with great tragic ending in it. And so we've had this wonderful broadcast run, and it's available free for streaming at pbs.org at your leisure, all three episodes. And I'd really invite you to look at it, because he's the ultimate American writer who's admired around the world. And we have a kind of international set of writers who talk about how influential he was to them as in their lives and their careers, and they analyze it along with a host of American writers and scholars who help us understand where he fits. And then we had access to the manuscript so we can see what a meticulous and disciplined writer he was. And then to the that give us the personal person, the person who's not editing himself, the person who's angry, who's happy, who's in love, who's jealous, who's vulnerable. And that belies a lot of the macho myth that Hemingway and the world projected, you know, big game hunter, deep sea fisherman, man about town, brawler, naturalist. All of that was true, but he had puffed it up into this impenetrable facade that didn't reveal an underlying sensitivity and empathy for others. And so, you know, he's considered a misogynist, you know, a hater of women. But in fact, several of his stories show an incredible sensitivity to women. And so it's just, it's mind-boggling. He is cruel to the women in his life, and to and some of the characters in his books and short stories are unsympathetic women. But at the same time, you've got the other thing. So you can't, it doesn't fit into a nice little box. It's not a black and white situation. It's just many, many fascinating shades of gray.
Now, Ken, for you, what is the inspiration? What inspires you in the documentary process?
Well, to me, all of my films are in American history. I love my country. I've spent the last 45 years making films about the U.S., but I've also made films about us. That is to say, the two-letter lowercase plural pronoun that looks like the U.S. So all of the intimacy of us and all of the majesty, all of the complexity, all the contradiction, even the controversy of the U.S. And what I've learned is that we, in our political lives, we like to set up opposites. But the thing that I've learned more than anything else in doing this for 45 years is there's only us. There's no them. We're always making a them up. And the them doesn't exist. It's all us. And when we get to that place, it's possible to be more tolerant and forgiving, not just of the neighbor or the other from another state or far away or different color or different religion or whatever it might be, but also the people closest to us and the people and us, you know, what's inside us. And so when you do a film on somebody like Hemingway, who's a large, outsized person, whose passions are really large, you can take heed from it, because in there are versions of something that you have, maybe to a minor degree, the jealousy of another or the competition with this person or the generosity in this situation. All of that Hemingway had in a very loud, blaring way. In some ways, he's like a Greek god in which the drama of the between their strengths and weaknesses are played out. And you use that to teach people moral lessons, social lessons. And Hemingway is a great cautionary tale, and also because his output is so fantastic, his literature is so great, and anybody can read it. It's very simple writing, or it appears to be simple, that anybody can enjoy. And he always said that, I want everybody to be able to read my stuff, and you can. If you've had an eighth grade education, there's nothing you're going to have problem with in Ernest Hemingway. It's just he's willing to go up and confront that a lot of us don't want to confront, you know.
When you work on the documentary process, I mean, a lot of folks, the music sets the scene for everything, but I know for you as yeah. well, the voice is huge for you. And I know you got an amazing lineup of voices to work on this project. And what does that mean for you on a personal level to see the support, I should say, of the other entertainers in the world as well?
Well, it's wonderful to have Jeff Daniels reading the voice of Hemingway. It's wonderful to have Meryl Streep reading one of his wives, Carrie Russell or Mary Louise Parker or Patricia Clarkson, but it's all music. You're right to bring up music. Hemingway was the same way. He was influenced by Bach and the repetition and counterpoint and repetition in Bach. And you can hear that in the way the words flow out when you read his stories. And so too for us, we treat a voice as if it's an instrument. We treat the narration as if it's an instrument, the picture, you know what I mean? So it's all about the timing and rhythm and pace of things. So I'm really, I'm glad you brought that up, and I'm so happy we had a chance to chat this morning.
That's right. And again, Ken, I would want to make sure and let everybody know where they can find more information about Hemingway and the other projects that you've got going on as well, sir.
Yeah, so you can stream it for free. Just go to pbs.org or any of your PBS platforms if you're familiar with them. And the next project up, starting September 19th, is a four-part, eight-hour biography of Muhammad Ali.
That's good stuff. Well, director Ken Burns, always great to visit with you, sir. I appreciate your time. Hope you have a great rest of your week, sir.
Thank you very much. You too.
Asking someone if they like surprises is dumb, because not all surprises are created equal. Now, someone polled 2,000 Americans and asked them to name the best and worst surprises you can get. Here are the 10 best. Number 1, randomly finding money, you know, like on the street or, well, even in your pocket. Number 2, surprise parties. Number 3, finding out you're getting money back on your taxes. Number 4, surprise visits from people you want to see, you know, like friends and family. Number 5, engagements or proposals. Number 6, pregnancies. Number 7, getting a new puppy or a new pet. Number 8, snow days when you were a kid. Number 9, canceled plans so you can just relax. And number 10, a deadline got pushed. Now, the worst surprises we experience include a bill that's higher than expected, finding out you owe money on your taxes, hearing your kid break something, finding out your pet had an accident in the house, and unexpected visits from people that you don't want to see. Our final guest on the episode today is, he led us into the episode, and he's going to lead us out as well, our good friend Brandon Allen on the line. And Brandon, always good to visit with you, brother.
Well, hello, my friend, and howdy from Central Texas here.
Now, Brandon, as we get into April, I mean, how are things starting to roll out music-wise there in the city of Austin?
Well, I'd say basically everything's kind of back on. All the venues have really started booking again. I'm booking about June 20th right now. That's how far out I'm actually scheduled. So that's wonderful news. And I'll fill in, you know, that's mainly implying, you know, Fridays, Saturdays and stuff, but I'll do some Sunday and Thursday things too, and off nights. But it would seem to me that it reminds me a lot of like that roaring 20s thing. Once alcohol got back into the equation, everybody was ready to party. You know, I feel like that's what's happening here.
How has the performances been? I mean, I know you've been playing all the way through the shutdown and everything. What have the crowds been like as of late, as opposed to the last 6 months previous?
Well, I think, you know, so much of what I was doing last year, there was only a portion of the people that, you know, were willing to go out and get out there and say, screw it, I'm going to listen to music anyway. And what I'm seeing now is a much, it's like a majority, I guess the exact opposite, where everybody's just ready and you're seeing faces out at venues that that you hadn't been seeing, that you thought would be there, you know, in terms of fans that you know. And I feel like everybody's kind of given in this point, and they're just ready to have their life back, at least to the live music extent of things. So, but yeah, venues, not all of them have went to 100% capacity, even if they have permission to do so, which they do down here. Some of them have decided to stay at like 50 and 75, but you know, that's just, that would be policy on the actual venue at that point. Not really mandatory.
Gotcha. How is the music recording process? I mean, I know the answer here. I'm kind of just leading you into it. I know you got some upcoming music. And how did the inspiration for the single that drops next weekend, how did that one come about for you?
Well, this On the Road Again, Willie cover that we're doing, it's fully instrumental. And you've known me a long time. You know I like to pick. So I wanted a song out there that kind of fit what was going on with, you know, the world, which is people are starting to get on the road again, right? And then there's that whole like, well, this is a real famous Willie tune. This would be kind of fun to cover it. So I got a few guys together in the studio, and we just put together what I thought was a very fun version that would do you know, do justice to the song without actually having to sing anything. We did it full instrumental. And then I went and recorded five other songs that are actual singles in terms of, you know, me singing and stuff that we would run out to a country radio. So I'm working on a full album. Recording's going well. I'm self-producing this album, which is something I haven't done ever. I've always had different producers I've worked with. I felt that I got to a point in my career where I'd been around it and I know what it want. I know what I want to sound like, and I know so many musicians and so many different types of players at this point. It made sense for me to just do it on my own and see what I could come up with. And I'm extremely excited about what we've got on these first six songs.
Now, Brandon, how's the learning curve self-producing the first time around?
Well, one of the things I had learned over the years was to not be in a rush. So I started recording in November, and we didn't finish these songs till this last couple weeks, you know, this first batch of six. So when you have that much time to work on it, you can go back and make changes and live with it a little bit. You know, when I'd cut records in Tennessee or Austin in the past, the studio time became such a factor that, you know, you'd run like blocks of time, you know, two or three days, and you felt you had to get something done. So sometimes you just force things out, and that can be good because then you're not overthinking things. But then it can be bad where you're not living with what you've done and you're just, you know, rubber stamping it and sending it to the mastering. And I don't know. This has been so much more fun for me in that regard. And I'm playing so much guitar on these records. Acoustics, electrics, I'm doing five guitars and the resonators. And, you know, usually I'd hire, you know, some of the utility guitar out just to save time in the studio, if that makes sense. And because I'm not in a rush, I'm doing this at a friend's studio, and we are just taking our time. And I'll tell you what, because the industry has changed so much, I don't really have to have a full record done right now anyway. I mean, it's no different than what we're talking about. We're talking about putting out singles, and, you know, I want to put out multiple singles this summer, you know, one obviously for radio, but then release this On the Road Again tune and a couple others. And so there's not this huge pressure to release a full album. However, that is my intention, is to turn these six into at least six tracks out of, you know, 10 or 12 that are going to be a full album. So I don't know. I make it up as I go, dude.
Now, how much has the landscape changed, and how hard is it to adjust your business model, your mentality to match what social media and plus the last 12 months have made us all do?
I mean, social media was really good to me in the last year because I was broadcasting live streams, you know, on one of the major lakes down here in Texas. And that was huge for me. I couldn't have played to that many people live. The irony of some of that was some of the states that were tuning in the most were like California and New Jersey and places like that outside of Texas, you know. And it was just like, wow. And it kind of made sense because, you know, they're under a much more strict deal in the states. So, you know, social media has played a huge role. I don't know if you were doing live streams, you know, at your station, but they got so popular that I think it almost watered them down. So if you were on the train early, like last March to, let's say, July, that was one thing. And then I felt like they kind of died off at that point, because everybody was doing them. And, you know, people were just tired of watching on their computer in general. But live music is so important to people. It just is, you know, music in general. The radio plays a huge role because in order to go see those bands, you kind of want to know who they are, right? Sometimes ahead of time. And that's where radio plays such a massive role and has helped me. And then there's the other side where you just play live and people stumble upon you and they see you that way the first time, the raw version, right? So I don't know. You just have to be good at what you do, I suppose.
That's right. Now, what did you learn from those live shows without people there? Did you change anything up in your presentation at all?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I upgraded my phone. I upgraded a secondary microphone. I did a live stream with it, right, where it was interactive. That's what I mean by that. So we all knew it was a live stream. But I actually got an iPad next to me so that I could be the one reading the comments and talking while, you know, the phone was doing the live stream. I thought that was a really great thing because it turned the live stream into an interactive live stream. I could take requests. I could make jokes. If it was somebody's birthday, I would know. So I could sing happy birthday to them. If it was their anniversary or on the lake, they'd say, "Hey, we're the one in the blue sparkly boat." And I could give them a shout out. And, you know, you could get such a better personal, more effective personal connection with everybody outside of just the fact that, you know, it was music and they needed something to be excited about. But on top of that, you were able to actually talk to them. And, you know, that was pretty cool. So yeah, I upgraded all the gear to make it sound better. And I even went and got a separate router from Verizon so that it would be like HD quality. So that what I'm sounding like, you know, live, is I'm giving it as close as I possibly can to that on the live stream.
That's awesome. Now, what music has inspired you, say, in the last few months lately?
Well, I always go through different records. You know, in this last month, I was listening to more Steve Miller again, which was one of the first concerts I ever went to. I always loved Steve Miller because some of the songs were kind of country, like Dance, Dance, Dance and stuff. And then some were just rock. I always just thought that was a cool band. And I'm always listening to Tom Petty because I'm always learning from Tom Petty's records. His songwriting and his casual delivery and just the way that the drums carry the song, but they're never overly complicated. I'm always like taking notes on stuff like that. And then, you know, on the countryside, I'm always keeping track of, you know, what Vince Gill is doing and Brad Paisley and some of those pickers, the Keith Urbans and stuff, just so I can see what they're up to and what new stuff they're coming out with. I feel like they're, Brad Paisley and Keith Urban are always doing something, you know, pretty modern anymore. And so it's always interesting to get that. And then Vince Gill is, you know, sticking to what Vince Gill is. And I always think that's cool too. So I really listen to everything, but you know, one thing I've been doing is learning all these Led Zeppelin acoustic songs. You forget how many of their famous songs had acoustic guitar in it. Cause you always think of Led Zeppelin as like rock, Les Pauls and Jimmy Page. But, you know, you go start going through it. You're like, no, man, that's an acoustic riff. That's an acoustic riff. And then, so I've been working on a medley where I've been putting all that together. And I don't know. I'm just having fun with it. The classic rock stuff always is fun to dig into because the genres weren't so defined back then. And you could listen to Jimi Hendrix and Fleetwood Mac and The Doors and Steve Miller and Tom Petty all on the same radio station back then, right? And so, you know, it didn't really matter. But I'm just trying to write new tunes that are not too long. Any song I put out, I try to keep it under 4 minutes, and I get bored after that. So how could I expect other people not to get bored? You know,
so. Is this song over yet?
Yeah.
Now what is the outlook as far as shows going into the fall? And like you said, looking to release hopefully a full album in the near future as well.
Yeah. So right now I'm obviously doing a lot of Texas, but I'm looking at doing Arizona starting in June, Colorado, hopefully Park City, just kind of do the mountains, if you will, for a little bit. And that'd be in the summer, like late June. And then some of the venues around here, I'm trying to get up your way, Oklahoma, get some of that going. From where I live, that gets to be a decent drive. You know, I'm 4 hours to, you know, North Dallas. from where I'm at least. And so it's just, you forget how much driving happens in this area of the country.
well, we don't, because you live in it too, but
you know, you talk to people from other places where they change states and cities and, you know, so quickly, it's like, oh, that's not how it works here.
not quite so close.
But yeah, I'm just working on full band stuff. One of the biggest things I'm transferring is, last year was so heavy on the solo acoustic stuff because it had to be. And this year I'm blending the full band shows back in. I'm making a major play on that, where hopefully 50-60% of that is turned over by September in realistic terms. So I'm booked mainly solo the next few months, but you'll start to see that turnover in June and July, I'm thinking.
Now, is it, when you get the full band back in there, is it kind of like riding a bike, or are there some painful moments as you try to feel it back out?
Well, I think, you know, people get rusty when they don't play a bunch. And even though I was playing a lot, the feel of the band is different. So you're going to want to have some rehearsals and tighten things up a little bit. And at the same time, it's no different than, you know, playing guitar at home and then all of a sudden landing on a stage. It feels different, and it's not going to be the same. So you just have to get out there and do it and work out the kinks live. That's part of the fun, part of what makes it. Part of what makes live music is there's a slight imperfection to it that people just love. That's what makes them remember the show, is, you know, what's said in between songs or things that happen in the show. You know, I think that's, to me, that's more fun than recording an album by far.
Now, Brandon, if folks want to find out more about the upcoming music, tour dates, find out when you're going to be nearby, what's the best place to do all that?
Well, you can go to Facebook, and it's just Brandon Allen Music, A-L-A-N, like two first names, Brandon Allen. And then there's the BrandonAllenMusic.net, and that'll take you anywhere, and that'll show you the tour dates, too, and let you hear some of the new tunes that are coming out. But, yeah, I'm hoping to really get out of the Central Texas area a lot more this year. I'm kind of lodged in between San Antonio and Austin, so I've got two great cities next to me, but I'm closer to Austin, and I've played there so much in my life that it would it'd be beneficial for me to go visit some other folks, like in Oklahoma.
Well, we got to make that happen, Brandon.
We will get it done. I know we can.
I got faith in us as well.
Heck yeah, man.
Well, Brandon, it's always great to visit you, man. I appreciate you taking some time to be on the show today, and we're going to let you play us out here in a few moments, but hope you have a great rest of your week, and we'll catch up again real soon, brother.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's always good talking to you, buddy.
Well, thanks again for joining me for this 57th episode in Season 2 of Good Questions with Cameron Dole. If you ever have a comment, a question, anything else you'd like to know, you can find me on all the socials at GQ with Cam. You can also reach me via the contact page at gqwithcam.com. If you'd like to help out in the funding for this podcast and keep us going, you can click on the shop tab at gqwithcam.com/shop. We've got everything from stickers to calendars, t-shirts, hoodies, hats, you name it, we've got them there. Of course, if you have a special guest idea, email me, gqwithcam@gmail.com. Well, thanks again, not only for being a guest on the episode, but for coming up with the theme music. This is our good friend, Brandon Allen. We're going to let him play us out. Hope you guys have a great rest of your Thursday.